It's hard to believe, but it's been nearly 9 months since we started our study of Hebrews. It feels like a little bit of a long time for me, because when we started this and I kicked it off, me and Grace were not expecting our second child, and now she's almost here, so it does feel like we've been at this for a little bit of time. But Lord willing, it looks like we'll wrap up the study before she comes, so maybe it's not quite that long. But I know back when I started the study for us and kicked us off with a two-week overview, one of the brethren told me that since I was going to be doing the overview, and since I was going to be spending a great deal of time then getting ready and kind of trying to understand the epistle as a whole, that this was going to be a study that I would end up being really invested in. And that's proven to be true. I know I've really enjoyed hearing from all the brethren and hearing kind of what everyone has brought forth and their perspective on this, and it's been a study that I've really learned a lot from. And while I won't be bookending this study, as Brother Mike Akins will be handling chapter 13 here in 2 weeks' time, I'll be speaking for the next two Sundays on Hebrews chapter 12. And again, while this doesn't necessarily wrap up the epistle as a whole, chapter 12 does in many ways wrap up the main argument that has been put forth by the author really throughout the entirety of Hebrews. Chapter 13 contains a great deal of wisdom, practical applications for us, a lot of interesting things there, and I'm sure Mike will do a great job on that, but it is a bit of a dramatic shift from chapter 12. It really presents kind of a great number of exhortations that are interspersed with kind of personal commentary from the author, whereas chapter 12 really caps off the argument that's been presented throughout this entire epistle about the superiority of Christ and Christianity to Judaism. As Brother Adam put it a few Wednesdays ago, this is really the climax of the book of Hebrews. This is really the peak of the argument. But it's also a chapter that contains some teaching that I would consider just to be a little difficult. Certainly wasn't easy for me to prepare for this, and I mean that in a few senses. For one, the chapter has a lot of lessons in it and a lot of teaching that I would consider to be pretty deep. Some things that I think you often have to look over a number of times, at least to prove true for me, to try to understand what exactly is being taught by the author. There's a number of lofty ideas that talk about how God interacts with us in ways that may not seem relatively apparent to us. It also contains a great deal of symbolism and metaphors, and so because of that, it's hard at times to look at it and immediately understand what is being talked about. There's a lot of passages that also, there's a little bit of debate about what exactly is meant by all these metaphors and all this symbolism that's there. So that's not easy for us either. And it's also a chapter with what I would just consider to be some straight difficult teaching. Teaching that is hard for us to accept, hard to apply, and is just not maybe the easiest thing to accept, and may at first blush may not be something we want to accept. I speak mainly about, we'll get into it today, the idea about the Lord disciplining us. That's a tough topic. That's a topic that I think many of us don't particularly enjoy thinking about. And when you add it all up, this was a class that was difficult for me to prepare for. It required a lot of study, and it was one that, you know, when I first went through the chapter, you know, I had to go through it again and spend a lot of time putting it together just because I don't think this is the easiest chapter out there in the New Testament. But at the same time, in going through it, I feel that I walked away with a much deeper understanding, a fuller understanding of what the author is trying to get across in chapter 12, and perhaps more importantly, how that fits in with the entire argument that is put forth in Hebrews, again, about Christ and Christianity's superiority to the Jewish faith. Now, as we begin to delve into the chapter, I think it's worthwhile to consider how it fits in with the entirety of Hebrews. I'm not going to go through and do an entire overview of the book. I did that 9 months ago. So instead, just really quickly, so far the author has shown us, among other things, that Christ is superior to the angels, superior to the prophets, that he's a superior sacrifice, a superior high priest. And now through him, we have a better promise, a better covenant, and that through Christ Jesus and his sacrifice, we can now be sanctified. And having established those things, really, I would say from chapter 1 through chapter 10, if you're going through it, you hit chapter 11 and you really see a total shift of the gears. You see what really seems to be a major outlier in the book. It's a little difficult for that to come across in a class like this, where we spend so much time going slowly through the chapters, and you don't really get a sense of that. But when you sit down and read the book of Hebrews, when you hit chapter 11, it feels different. And it's easy to, when you first see it, wonder, frankly, for me, what in the world is going on here? I mean, we've been going through all these arguments showing the superiority of Christ, and now we get this giant list of all these people from the Old Testament, all these people, primarily of the Jewish faith, that did these incredible things, and it's easy to wonder, why is this here? What is the point? Why to go to such exacting detail for that? And in some ways, it's a shift that when you first look at it, not only is it just a total change of pace, for me, it's one, when I first looked at it, I wondered, you know, this almost seems contrary to what we've been talking about. Because if you were trying to convince Jewish converts to Christianity about the superiority of Christ and Christianity, why go through all these great figures of the Jewish faith? That almost seems the opposite of what you would want to do. Because as we know at this point, the Jews' heritage had become all important to them. I know Brother Jerry has often said from the pulpit that at this point in the Jewish history, that their religion had become their God. And I think that's a great way to put it, and I think that's very true. But I think we're also to the point where you could say that their heritage had become their God. That the people of their past and their events and their ability to stand on the past and say that they are Jews, that that had become their God. And I think that's especially true today in the sense that there are many people out there who are self-proclaiming Jews who aren't practicing any sort of religion, who really are just looking at that as heritage-based. And that was true at this time as well. And so if that is the case, if these are people who we know their heritage, their past, and the people that made a part of that, if that is what is so important to them, if that is what filled them up with pride and that's what filled them up with feelings of superiority, why bring that up at all? Why stir up those feelings when that may have been one of the things that was holding them back? And I believe that part of that answer lies in verses 39 and 40 of chapter 11, which state, "And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." Now this explains, partly I believe, why this list is here, that the author explains that these individuals accomplished all of these incredible things through faith, yet they did not have the promise that we have. They did not have the promise of Christ. And that because of that, they were not made perfect apart from us, but rather made perfect with us. But still, it'd be easy to look at that and wonder, you know, in some ways, so what? Or, you know, what is the point of that? Because that still doesn't really fit in at first blush with the entirety of this argument that's being put forth. And really, all of that is serving for the transition to chapter 12. And that's really what I believe chapter 11 is primarily about. That giant list supports that statement in verses 39 and 40, which then supports the entirety of chapter 12. And that central idea that these individuals, these heroes of their faith, that they strove and that they fought for the Lord, they strove for him, that they suffered, they had to deal with afflictions, they had to deal with persecution, torture, and death, and that they did those things without Christ. Therefore, as we have Christ, how much more can be expected of us? And that is really ends up being kind of the central point of chapter 11. That's really the backbone, then, of chapter 12. I would say that always hangs in the background of chapter 12, that idea that you should be able to do more than those people in chapter 11, that what is being asked of you is not too much because you have Christ Jesus. And I think that really shines through as we go through this chapter, and we see that they need to keep that in mind as they know that they're going to deal with discipline from the Lord, they're going to deal with trials and persecution, and ultimately they are going to face judgment from the Lord. I think this point is also so necessary when you consider the history of the Jews, and especially where the Jews at this time fit into that history. When this epistle was written, it was roughly 600 years since the Jews had begun to return from the captivity. And while that process took some time, they are now at a point in their history where they've really enjoyed a few hundred years of relative peace, of relative ease in some ways. Certainly the last 120 years or so of their history of having to deal with the Romans wasn't the most easy for them. There was certainly some corrupting influences from the Romans that we know that they chafed under, especially the perversion of the position of the high priest and things of that nature. But for the most part, they didn't have to deal with the type of difficulties. They didn't have to face the type of persecution and the sacrifices made by those people described in chapter 11. Rome was mainly concerned with just keeping the peace in the area, avoiding opening up another new war, and keeping the tax money rolling in. That was really the assignment if you were the governor to one of these provinces. Those were your goals, along with lining your own pockets, so trying to keep the Jewish faith under your thumb really wasn't what they were interested in. So really you have this period in time where these Jews have enjoyed relative peace for quite a while. And if you were one of the Jewish converts to Christianity that this epistle is speaking towards, you could see how it would be difficult to look back at your former life, one that was really relatively free from persecution, one that was relatively easy in some ways, where you weren't having to deal with pushing back on what you wanted to do in terms of your religion, the fact that they were all looking for what they believed was the coming of the Messiah, and that the fact they were going to be freed from Rome. And now, as we'll get into, now they're having to deal with this discipline from the Lord that they may not understand. And they're trying to do that while trying to accept what ends up really being the tumultuous life of a first century Christian. And so I think this argument would really help them to understand and see that the history of those who have served the Lord is not that similar to what their current predicament is, or their current state as Jews living in that area. That in reality, the history of those who have served the Lord has been one of sacrifice, one of suffering for their God. That's made especially plain if we look back, and feel free to turn here to chapter 10 of the book of Hebrews. I'll read verses 36 through 39, and that directly precedes then chapter 11. That reads, "You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. I take no pleasure in the one who shrinks back. But we do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved." So this is really, I think, the other part of what he's trying to get across to them here, is that idea that these people in chapter 11, that they were able to persevere. And that's what he's encouraging them to do to now. That he's making it plain that while their prior lives as Jews, compared to where they're at now as Christians, was one of relative ease, where they weren't facing persecution, that is not indicative of the history of those who have served God, and that they need to show that same perseverance as they did before. But as I mentioned before, the main reason the author points out these facts, that these individuals were not only able to persevere, as he's encouraging them to, but that they were able to persevere for the Lord in faith to accept their good report, but they did that without the promise of Christ. And that's worth considering a bit more, because just imagine how hard it would have been to suffer for the Lord, to strive for the Lord, to deal with all those afflictions dealt with in chapter 11, and to do that and not necessarily always see the fulfillment of those promises. It's just such a different concept than what we have today. And I struggle to imagine what it would have been like for one of those individuals in chapter 11 to do that without the full picture, without a full understanding of what is going on. And that's the point the author is trying to make here, that in Christ we have such an advantage. Obviously, we strive our entire lives for a promise that comes at the end if we too receive a good report. But here in this life, we obviously have the advantage of Christ and him interceding with the Lord on our behalf. We have the advantage of the Holy Spirit. We have the advantage of the church. And furthermore, we have that advantage of being able to see the whole picture. And I think that is what is so important for us when we consider this, because we know that to whom much is given, for much will be required. And since we have those advantages, there is no excuse for us. We should be able to accomplish more when we persevere through the Lord in faith, because we have a more perfect faith. And setting that groundwork then is as we transition into chapter 12, I think is so important as we get into the meat of the chapter, because that idea of perseverance, which really, again, runs from the end of chapter 10 all the way through chapter 11, I would consider that to also really be the true theme of chapter 12 if I had to pick one. That really runs all throughout, that idea of persevering and that idea of being able to do more now that we have Christ. But before we actually get into the chapter, I did want to pause and see really quick if there's any comments or questions that anyone has. I don't know where Bill is, so someone else have to grab the mic if anyone has something to say. Thank you, Alan. All right, you get off the hook, Alan. So there's a lot of different ways we could break up the chapter, but for starters, let's just go ahead and take a look at verses 1 and 2. If you want to go ahead and turn there, I'll read those here. "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, the idea of comparing our Christian walk and comparing what we go through as Christians to a race is not singular to the book of Hebrews. We see that elsewhere, such as 1 Corinthians 9:24 through 27. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. But I discipline my body, and I bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. Or we could look at 2 Timothy 4, 6-8. For I already am being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. And I believe that here, this comparison is just so apt. And there's other ways the author could have gone about this. They could have compared it to battle, kind of you think to the idea of the whole armor of God in Ephesians 6. They could have looked to describe it as, you know, an actual physical combat, physical fighting, as we see both in those two passages I read, 1 Corinthians 9, where there Paul describes that he fights not as one who beats the air, or the passage from 2 Timothy where it says, I have fought the good fight. They could have described it in that way, but here I think it is just so applicable, makes so much sense to describe this as a race when we get into what is being asked of them. And to the readers, the idea of a race likely would have brought forth the idea of long-distance running, popularized by the Greeks. I know that's a tradition that stems from the legendary Greek messenger Philippides, who ran the roughly 26 miles from the Battle of Marathon back to Athens along the way, casting off his armor and his clothes so he could keep ahead of false Persian runners, to arrive there, declare that they had defeated the Persians, and then collapse and die. And some people, I will say, as a bit of an aside, look at this passage and the fact that a race is referenced here and believe that this is indicative of this epistle being directed solely towards the churches of Christ in Greece as they would have understood this reference. That's not something I agree with. We see throughout the Old Testament different references to races, such as in Psalms 19 and 5, where it describes a strong man running his course, or Ecclesiastes 9 and 11, where it says that the race isn't to the swift. We also know at this time that Greek influence had really spread all throughout the Mediterranean. I recently read a book about kind of the history of Rome leading up to the fall of the Roman Republic, and one of the things the author brought forth was the fact that many Romans were troubled by how deep the Greek culture had, in their minds, infiltrated their own. That was what all the young men were studying, that young men were being sent there, and they're bringing tutors back. So I don't believe that the fact that this is here, even if this is referencing more of a Greek-style marathon type of race, I don't believe that's indicative of the fact that this epistle was directed towards that. It's a bit of an aside, but I think it's important to bring out as in my studies on this book, when I was getting ready to do the overview, I ran into a lot of times where it felt as if people tried to limit the scope of this letter. And I believe that this letter was intended to all Jewish converts to Christianity. And so I just put that in there, as I don't necessarily agree with that line of thinking. But getting back to the topic at hand, I believe that envisioning this type of race is perfect for what it requires. Preparation, discipline, and perseverance. I don't know anything about running marathons. That is not anything I am interested in. If that's something that interests you, that's great. But for me, it's just not my thing. But I can understand at least theoretically what it requires. It requires preparation. You have to train yourself. You have to be able to get ready to do something that's this physically demanding. You have to be disciplined. You can't just eat and drink whatever you want leading up to a race or while you're training if you want to perform in the manner that you do. And it requires perseverance, both in all of those things, but also during the race itself. No matter how well trained you are, at some point you're going to have to push your body a little further, and you're going to have that perseverance. And if you don't have all of those things together, it's not going to work. It doesn't matter how determined you are to finish the race. If you say, I am going to do this, if you don't train, it's probably not going to happen. I couldn't go out right now, and no matter how much I told all of you I was going to finish it, I'm not betting that I'm going to be able to pull it off. It also doesn't matter how hard you train if you lack that discipline. If leading up to the race, you're just doing whatever you want, you're eating, you're drinking whatever you want, you're not getting the necessary rest, it's not going to matter. You're not going to pull it off. And it doesn't matter how disciplined you are, if as soon as you get into that race and things start to get difficult, as soon as your body starts to really get tired or exhausted, if you just say, I've had enough. And just like that race, our race of faith requires those exact same conditions. We have to prepare ourselves for what is to come. We know that difficulties lie ahead. Many of us, and I myself included, believe that more difficulties lie ahead for those of us in this room, in this country, as we go forward. And we need to be willing to see those challenges, to be ready for them, and not shrink away and also not be ignorant of them. We also have to be disciplined. We can't just allow ourselves to fall into any sort of carnal influences or carnal temptations every time they crop up. And we have to persevere. This life is a long one, God, Lord willing, and that we have to be ready to run this race and do those things for a long time. And these ideals tie right in with what is described there in verse 1. And a bit furthermore, in what is described there, where it says the setting aside of all weight and the sin that is ensnares, as I look at that as part of the preparation for running the race. Aside from looking, in my opinion, super cool in the outfits they wear when people are running marathons, they wear those things because that is casting aside weight. That's going to let them go farther and run faster. But here, there's some interesting ideas we can bring out if we look at those two things. The Greek word here for weight is oikos, and that is a singular word to the New Testament used here. And it really carries the idea of a weight that is attached, that's hooked onto something, which is rather a vivid and a graphic warning. The idea of that weight being hooked onto you and dragging you down, that's a pretty stark warning. But that is consistent with the teachings of Christ. If we look at the structure of this passage, we see how it describes the weight and it describes the sin that ensnares. So I believe that when it refers to the weight here, that's not talking about sin, but rather I think that is the weight of the world. That's the cares of the world, the distractions of the world, things that might not necessarily be in and of themselves sinful, but the things that detract, the things that pull us away. So we can think of Christ with the rich young ruler in Matthew 19, where he said, "If you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me." And that the rich young ruler, as we know, went away sorrowful. Or we can think of Luke 9, where Christ told the man to let the dead bury the dead in regards to his own father. Instances where Christ was telling people that they need to shed the cares of the world if they are to follow him. Shifting our focus then to the idea of casting aside what it says here, the sin that so easily ensnares, the Greek word for ensnares is also singular to the New Testament in this passage, and from what I found in my studies, this is not the easiest word for people to define in the Greek. I know there's a lot of debate out there, and it's just not the easiest word for us to understand in the present time, but from what I could tell, we know at least the word meant the idea of being caught in infliction or caught in peril. And I think that's a really perfect way to describe sin, that it's something that ensnares us, it surprises us, and that we find ourselves immediately caught in peril. So between these two, we have the weight that we carry with us. That would be the concerns, the distractions and diversions of our life here in this world, as well as those sins that suddenly befall us, that suddenly grab us and ensnare us. And it's the difference between, if we're going back to the race metaphor, carrying with you, you know, an excessively heavy backpack to run a marathon, or the idea of tripping over a root as you get 10 feet from the starting line. And for me, as I prepared for this, when I came to this passage, I kind of paused and really tried to give some thought to my own life. What cares of the world hold me back? This was especially applicable as I was getting ready for this, as I was thinking, what cares of the world have held me back from getting ready for this class? As I, you know, as I was getting kind of gearing up for it, there's just a lot going on in my life. And I asked myself, and I would encourage you to do the same, what cares are there of the world that hold you down? What distractions are there that keep you back from needing to do what needs to be done as a follower of Christ? In the same sense, what sins are there that you can cast aside that so easily ensnare you? And again, these aren't novel ideas. These aren't new thoughts, clearly. But these are ones that I think are very important questions for us to ask. And I also think that this is an interesting way of looking about it. And perhaps in doing so, you could come up with some new conclusions. Moving on then to verse 2. Here we see the author shift from the examples of faith from the prior chapter to the ultimate example of faith in our Savior, Christ Jesus, who the author describes as the author and finisher of our faith. Now, the Greek word here for author appears throughout the New Testament and is rendered oftentimes in different ways. I know in the New King James in Acts 3 and 15, it's rendered prince, and in Hebrews 2 and 10, it's rendered captain. So we could easily say perhaps the leader of our faith, or I think kind of marrying what I think the author's trying to get across here, the beginner and leader of our faith. But he's not only the beginner and leader of our faith, but as it says here, it's the finisher of our faith, that you could say he's the completer of our faith. And I think there's a definite parallel here to the description of the Lord being the Alpha and the Omega, but here with Christ being the beginning and the end of our faith, with Christ serving not only as the one who began our faith, and he's the leader of our faith, but the one who completed it, or as it says in the last two verses of chapter 11, that he's the one who perfected our faith. Moving on then in verse 2, the author states regarding Christ, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, considering the first part of that, where it describes the joy that was set before him, that's something that I don't know if I've considered that in the past as much as I should. That idea of Christ having that joy that he knew was before him. I always think of Christ's death as an act of obedience to the Father. I think of Christ in the garden, where it says that he was sorrowful unto death, and that he was struggling with this decision, what he had to do, struggling with wanting that cup to pass from him. But here we can tell that Christ still knew the joy that was before him once he went through this, once he pushed past the agony and the shame. I believe part of that is what's referenced here in the verse, where it says that he knew he would soon return to the Father and be seated at his right hand. But I also believe that Christ would have known the joy that would come through what his death would accomplish, what that would provide to all men. And I find that to be a comforting idea for me, that Christ, leading up to his death, it wasn't only him having to deal with the knowledge that he was going to go through something so horrible, through the shame of the cross, but that he knew going through with it would ultimately lead to joy. Considering in the middle part there, where it references Christ enduring the cross and despising the shame, that's a verse that has always spoken to me. I remember I came across that relatively early on when I came to Christ through the waters of baptism. And it's something that just always stuck with me, because I think it's so easy to overlook the idea that Christ's death for him would have been considered a shameful one. That would have been a hard thing for him to accept. I know it's hard then for us to think about that, the fact that the only sinless man to ever live had to die a death that was reserved for the worst of criminals. It was a death that was designed to be humiliating, to be horrible, and to be as much of a spectacle as possible to dissuade other people from those crimes. For us, we can never separate the glory of the cross, which we sing about, which for Christ it would have been nothing glorious at all to hang on that cross, but for us, we can never separate the glory of the cross with the fact that that was capital punishment. I know Barnes wrote in his commentary that he compared it to, in his time, to death at the gallows, that that would have carried a negative connotation. That would have been a shameful way for someone to die. In our modern times, you can think, if Christ had to die by means of capital punishment we have today, would that not be a shameful death? Would that not be a hard thing for Christ to have to suffer through? Now, before we move on to the next few verses, I did want to go ahead and pause again for any comments or questions that anyone may have. No, I appreciate that. And that's a good point, as we'll get into. There is, you know, the fact that Christ was, as the only sinless man, was numbered with the sinners, and they viewed him as a sinner. And that would have been obviously a difficult thing for him to accept. So appreciate that, Jerry. Anyone else then? Oh, Alan?
One of the things, going back to verse 1 there, that we might consider is, when we're running the race, we do not get to choose the course. We have to follow after Christ. Take a glance at Ephesians 2:10 there, that we are created in such a way to do things in such a way. And so we don't get to choose the race. We don't get to choose the course of that race either.
No, that's a very good point. And I do think, and we'll get into it further as we go, that so much of this chapter, the reason the author is trying to encourage them to persevere is because of the fact that he knows what's before them. He knows where they're coming from and where they're immediately going. What is going to happen to them? What's going to happen to the Christians as they get into kind of the rise of Nero as the emperor of Rome? And he's trying to prepare them for that. And I think he's trying to get them to see what you're saying, that, you know, You don't get to pick where you're going. You need to accept it. You need to prepare yourself. So thank you, Alan. All right, well, if no one else, we'll go ahead then and take a look at verses 3 and 4, which read, "For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin." Now, here we see a bit of the same thought coming through as the prior two verses, that really this is dealing with the idea, I believe, of suffering through persecution. Now, consider here then in verse 3, the author is now positioning Christ as, I believe, above those who's been mentioned in chapter 11. This is where he's trying to remind them that, you know, you have all these examples, you need to set those aside in a way, because now we're going beyond that. Christ being the ultimate example of those things that those people in chapter 11 demonstrated. Faithfulness to God, even in the face of persecution. Because Christ had to bear with the words and the actions of sinners, those who he was trying to come to show their sinful ways, that they continued sinning around him. He had to bear with those who had hard hearts, who rejected him, and he had to bear with those who hated him. That's aside from the fact that he had to bear all of those things unto death. And the King James renders the word hostility as contradiction. And I think that is actually a translation I prefer and really gets into what Jerry was talking about. Because this was sinners who Christ was coming to show that they were sinners, telling Christ he was the sinner, that they were saying that he was of a demon, that the workings of the Holy Spirit were actually of the devil, that, you know, the unpardonable sin. In that sense, what greater contradiction could there be than sinners telling Christ he was the sinner? And yet, how do we see Christ respond? He responded with love and with patience, but most applicable for us here, we never saw him become discouraged or to give up in his ministry, as I'm sure, frankly, all of us probably would have when we went out into a world that was so unrelenting, to a world that was so unreceptive to him. The latter part of verse 3 tells us to consider Christ, lest we become weary and discouraged in our souls. And we can all relate to this. As I got ready for this class, I became weary at times. This was a hard class for me to get ready for. We have a lot going on in our lives, getting ready for the baby, work's busy, got a lot going on at home, trying to get ready for the baby to come. And so for me, there were times where I was wearied by getting ready for this. And I say that to my shame, because as it's pointing out here, we're not even talking at all about dealing with weariness through having to deal with persecution. And it's important for us to look at Christ then, because we too don't have to deal with persecution unto death yet either, because he never became discouraged. We see him set aside time in his life to seemingly meditate to the Father, or meditate and pray to the Father, and to, it seems, recharge his batteries and be ready to face what was ahead, but yet we never saw Christ give up or become discouraged. But as I've alluded to, I believe that this passage is primarily speaking not to necessarily just the daily struggles and weariness that may come from being a Christian, but rather hostility from sinners or potentially persecution. I know the chapter moves on a little bit or shifts a little bit after verse 4, but in verse 4 it says, "You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin." There is some debate about what this means. One of the schools of thought that I agree with is that this is referring to the fact that this group of Christians at this time have not yet had to experience widespread persecution to the point of death or martyrdom. We know that that is coming, and that lines up with our general assumptions about when this epistle was written, that it likely would have fallen right before the rise of Nero and eventually kind of the widespread persecution of Christians. But it makes sense then in that context that here the author is trying to prepare them for what is to come. And in many ways, he's pointing out, and that segues nicely to the next section, that he's saying, you haven't been persecuted unto death yet, but yet you are already weary with simply the discipline you receive from the Lord. And that's an important thing for us to consider, because we too may weary in the same manner. We may weary from the discipline from the Lord, even though we too have not experienced persecution unto death yet in our time. However, there is another school of thought here. It's not one that I necessarily agree with, but I certainly couldn't make an argument 100% one way or the other, that people believe that this passage is referring to Christ in the garden when his sweat was as drops of blood, saying that they have not strived against sin in the manner that Christ, they have not fought that hard against sin in their own lives. So again, that's something that you'll have to make up your own mind on. Now, next we're going to tackle a little bit larger section, so again, I will pause for any comments or questions before we get into 5 through 11. Now, that is a good point and a good reminder, as I brought out earlier, that not only is the author telling them to look at those examples of 11, you know, Elijah included, and saying, look what they did without Christ, but yet you should be able to go further now. So thank you, Dan. Anyone else? All right. Well, let's go ahead then and proceed on. We'll pause somewhere in the middle of this for questions and comments because it's a larger section, but let's take a look at verses 5 through 11. And I will admit, this section was a tricky one for me to prepare for. For whatever reason, I hadn't spent much time prior to this considering the idea of Christ disciplining the faithful here on this earth. I obviously understood that there are earthly consequences to our earthly actions, and that even when we come through the waters of baptism and we are forgiven by the Lord for those sins and they're washed away, that we may still have to deal with the earthly consequences to those earthly actions, even if they're washed away in the eyes of the Lord. But I hadn't given much thought to the idea about, aside from those earthly consequences, that while we're here on this earth, that the Lord may be disciplining us. And perhaps that's just to my shame, but I feel as if that's not something, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about or talking about. But I will say, after having gone through this and considering my own walk, I believe there's times that when I look back on my life as a Christian, that there's times where I think I can see the hand of the Lord disciplining me for what I was doing. But backing up and looking at verses 5 and 6, here we see a quote from Proverbs 3, 11 and 12, with 5 and 6 reading, "And have you forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons? My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives." Now, this is obviously a passage from the Old Testament, therefore would have been in Hebrew, but the Greek word here for chastening is a singular word in its usage in the New Testament to this spot, and I think makes it clear what it's talking about, is that Greek word really brings forth the idea of discipline and corrective action, as if, you know, if there was any confusion about what's being talked about here. Now, in verse 5, it speaks to despising the chastening or being discouraged by the rebuking. And I think that generally and broadly speaks to the fact that there are times where we can approach this chastening in the wrong manner, where we could not accept it as we should. Now, if someone fails to accept the discipline, I think that's because that they could, one, disregard it outright, two, fail to understand it or recognize its heavenly purpose, or three, that they could have contempt for it. I think that's broadly speaking the three ways that someone could fail to accept the heavenly discipline from the Lord. And ironically, that is so similar to disciplining children. The author compares our heavenly father to our earthly father later on in this chapter, but I can't avoid the comparison here. I discipline our 2-year-old daughter, Hazel. If it doesn't work, it's really for one of three reasons. One, she didn't care. This doesn't happen very often, but there have been times where, you know, whatever discipline that we've laid out so thoughtfully and intelligently just doesn't do a thing. I think about early on, timeouts are effective for her. If you know our daughter, the idea of sitting in a corner not talking to anyone for a few minutes is difficult for her, as it is for me, but that's usually pretty effective. But early on, I remember, you know, we tried it, and I walked past her room, and she was in the crib, and she was just in there talking to herself, having the best time, and I'm like, well, that didn't really work. So that could be one of the things that, you know, a child just doesn't care. Whatever you've done is not effective. It could also be because they're confused. There's times where I know I've disciplined her and she didn't understand why. She didn't understand what she did wrong. She didn't understand the expectation. She doesn't understand what we're doing. What's the purpose of this? The idea that, you know, this seems to be just a cruel action that's going on, that may be persisting. Or thirdly, it could be because she has contempt for it. And even at the age of 2, I've seen this in her. And there's times where I've disciplined her and I've looked into her eyes and I'm like, well, that's contempt. And that's something we're going to have to work through right now. But that is just so similar to the exact ways we can fail when we are disciplined by the Lord, that if we're not careful, we could let that discipline roll off our backs, we may not recognize it for what it is, or we could have contempt for it. Worst of all, we may look at it and we may not understand it in any which way. And rather, I think we should consider, when we discipline a child, what do we want from them? We want them to have an understanding of what they did wrong. What was the expectation, and how do they come up short of that? We want them to understand that this is for their own good. This isn't some cruel thing I'm doing to you for my own amusement. Rather, this is for your own good for whatever reason. I need you to understand that you need to listen to me. Whatever it is, that is a greater good we're pushing for. And lastly, we want them to have that sense of guilt, and we want them to strive to be better. And there you go. Those are the exact same things that we should do when we're disciplined by the Lord. Now, I'm assuming, Alan, with the kids coming up, that we are out of time. Okay, well, does anyone have any last comments or questions before all the kids come up? All right, well, I appreciate your time, and we'll pick up there next week.